Good evening. I've appreciated the Ephesians series, and some of you will be happy to know, and some of you will be unhappy to know, this is my last sermon in this series, but it has been a blessing. So today we're going to tackle Ephesians chapter 6 and verses 5 through 9. It'll just take us a while to get there. The passage reads, "Bondservants, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling, with a sincere heart, as you would Christ, not by the way of eye service as people pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with a good will as to the Lord, and not to man, knowing that whatever good anyone does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether he is a bond servant or is free. Masters, do the same to them, and stop your threatening, knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and that there is no partiality with him." This is a rather sensitive topic, a passage, because it has become increasingly popular over the past several years to say that the Bible defends or condones or promotes slavery, and to attack Paul specifically, to attack Moses for allowing slavery, and for saying, and for not just outright saying, free your slaves and start a free society. So part of what I'm going to do here is I'm going to go back to the law in the Old Testament and take a look at what does the Bible say about slavery, and what is slavery, before we get back here to Ephesians. Part of the dilemma is that as Americans, our view of slavery is defined by the antebellum slavery of America. And so when we think of slavery, we think of very specific ethnic groups who are consigned to slavery, and their families are consigned to slavery, and they are property with no rights and so on. And we tend to take that idea and then to say all slavery is that. All slavery does take away liberty and free rights. And so it is not at all something that as believers we would say is a good thing, and I don't think the Bible says it's a good thing either. So what I'm going to do is go back to Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy and take a look at the passages there where God talks about the law, because just talks about slavery in the law, because this is what will inform the Old Testament. Okay, every book in the Old Testament, all the actions in the Old Testament would have gone back to the law. And of course, same with Jewish New Testament believers. They would have done the same. And so I want to spend some time basically walking through these passages. This is not really an apologetic sermon. Okay, I'm not defending anything necessarily. Rather, this is more an explanatory. I'm going back to the law and saying, what does the law say, and what does that mean specifically for us? So we're going to go back all the way to Exodus chapter 21. To give context, Exodus 20 is the Ten Commandments. And so that is the very beginning of the law. And so here where God begins to talk about slavery is actually at the very beginning of giving all the law. So here we're going to go through two passages in Exodus, a couple in Leviticus, and four shorter passages in Deuteronomy, I think, to get a full picture. So Exodus chapter 21, verses 1 through 11. "Now these are the rules that you shall set before them. When you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years. And in the seventh, he shall go out free for nothing. If he comes in single, he shall go out single. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, The wife and her children shall be her masters, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out for free, then his master shall bring him to God, and he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall bore his ear through with an awl, and he shall be his slave forever. When the man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. If she does not please her master, who has designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has broken faith with her. If he designates her for a son, he shall deal with her as with a daughter. If he takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, or her marital rights. And if he does not do these three things for her, she shall go out for nothing, without payment of money. So this is our first introduction to slavery and the law. Specifically, who are these slaves? What people are these slaves? These are Jewish people. This is not talking about people who are not Jews. He's not saying you can go out to the Egyptians, to the Moabites, and enslave them. He's talking about their own Jewish people as slaves. I don't have time to go through it verse by verse, for which some of you thank me, but I want to give general principles here. So first of all, we see here that slavery is meant to be temporary. Okay, it's 6 years, and a seventh year, you free the slave. So a slave for 6 years, then you're freed on the seventh. The slave might prefer permanent slavery, which seems odd to us. Why would he prefer to be a slave permanently? And we'll get to that in a later passage. I just want to make a comment, though, on verse 4, where it says, if his master gives him a wife and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife or children shall be her masters, and he shall go out alone. This does not mean that the wife and the children are forever slaves. You have the six-year slavery. So it's a staggered slavery. So that means when his time is up, his wife and kids may have another 4 years, 3 years, 2 years before they are free. They don't automatically get to leave with him, is the point of this. Really, as most of we see in the law, the law provides more liberty. not restriction, but... and then verses 7 and following, the idea of selling a daughter to a slave is culturally talking about marriage. And this seems really harsh to us. You know, you're going to sell your daughter into marriage. Okay? Except remember, back then, all marriages were arranged marriages. So it's not, the difference here is not that in this scenario, the father chooses who she marries. He always chooses who she marries. The difference is, in this particular case, there is no dowry. Okay, the daughter is in exchange for something, probably debt relief. But what we do see here with the verses 7 through 11, however, is that marriage is honored and the wife is honored. I just want to point out a couple of things here. In verse 8, if she does not please her master, who has designated her for himself, okay, then whose fault is that? The blame is laid on whom if she does not please her master? It's laid on him, not on her. It's not her fault. It's his fault. And so the blame is laid on him. He shall let her be redeemed. He has no right to sell her to foreign people, since he has broken faith with her. And then the passage goes on and talks about different rights. And so what it's doing here is it's saying, listen, just because you made an arranged marriage with a poor man to get his daughter does not mean you treat that daughter any less than you would any other wife. Okay, she is given the full rank and privileges of a wife. You can't deny her any of that. So it's a protective text. Okay. So see here, in this passage, all we really learn in this passage is slavery is temporary unless he voluntarily chooses otherwise. And if a daughter, part of arranged marriage, can be part of debt relief, and in that scenario, she is to be honored as a full wife, not as somebody who is a lesser person because of how she became his wife. I'm going to jump down to verse 16. One thing the law does not do, it does not put all the verses on slavery together. Okay, it kind of jumps around a bit. Verse 16, whoever steals a man and sells him, and anyone found in possession of him, shall be put to death. Okay, and so this fits into the scenario, because we learn here, you can't abduct a slave. Okay, slavery is a voluntary choice. You don't get to go out and enslave somebody and say, you are now my slave because of whatever reason. And if you do, then you're put to death. It's capital punishment for enslaving a man. Then you jump down to verses 20 to 21 in the same chapter, giving extra laws on slaves. When a man strikes his slave, male or female, with a rod, and the slave dies under his hand, he shall be avenged. Okay, what that basically means is the slave's family can come and he can kill the master. Okay, avenged. Be avenged. The law later sets up cities of refuge, right? So the master could flee to a city of refuge where he's not allowed to be touched. But the system that's set in place is, if you kill a man, then your blood is shed also by his family. But in verse 21, if the slave survives a day or two, he is not to be avenged, for the slave is his money. So if the slave does not die, the family can't come and kill the master because he's not dead. Okay, so really what you have here is equality. It's an equality principle. Okay, the slave's life is worth just as much as the master's. It can be avenged. And the master's life is worth just as much as the slave's. He can't die for, you know, abusing him. So what does it mean then when it says that the slave is his money? It seems really harsh. Until you jump down to verses 26 and 27. Verses 26 and 27... here in chapter 21, when a man strikes the eye of his slave, male or female, and destroys it, he shall let the slave go free because of his eye. If he knocks out the tooth of the slave, male or female, he shall let the slave go free because of his tooth. This law is not saying this only takes place with an eye or a tooth. The principle here is, if you abuse a slave, then you forfeit the right to own a slave. And you let the slave go free. And so jumping back then to verse 21, that explains why it says the slave is his money. If he strikes the slave and he does not die, he still goes free, and you've lost that money, is what that means. So this is what we learn from Exodus chapter 21 regarding slavery. If you come to this passage and you read into it with the idea of American antebellum slavery, then you can find a lot of harsh things to see in this chapter. If you come at this chapter with a perspective that slavery was a common economic system to alleviate poverty, then it has a whole nother perspective, because at this point now you're seeing. So what Moses is doing is he is not saying you're allowed slaves and here are things you can do with them. Rather, he's saying slavery exists, but here are restrictions on what you are and are not allowed to do with them. So chapter 21, we find out about Hebrew slavery, okay? The people within the Jewish nation, they can be a slave for 6 years, but no more than that. And there are certain restrictions, okay? If you abuse them, they go free. If you kill them, then your life is forfeit. If you abduct them, your life is forfeit. going to jump to chapter 22, Exodus 22, verses 21 and 22. I'm sorry if this seems very tedious, but so verses 21 and 22. You shall not wrong a sojourner or oppress him. Okay, a sojourner, this is somebody who's not Jewish, somebody from another nation who was living with the Jews. Okay, he is not, remember, God is giving them this land. Okay, this is their land. So somebody who's not Jewish living on the land is a sojourner. And he continues, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. So there in verse 21, this is what I'm calling the redemptive principle. And this appears a lot throughout the law and throughout the Old Testament. And I think you can't really understand what the law says about slavery until you understand the redemptive principle. The core basis of the law here is the covenant with God. He says, I redeemed you from Egypt. You understand what it's like to be a slave. And so you take that knowledge and you use it as you deal with other people. You know what it's like to live in a land that's not yours. So you use that knowledge in how you deal with people who are living in your land. So you shall not wrong a sojourner or oppress him, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. Okay, oppress would include slavery. Okay, you can't enslave a sojourner. All right? When a Moabite or an Ammonite moves to Israel, they can't enslave him because, hey, you're not Jewish, you're in our land. You can't oppress him. And he continues, you shall not mistreat any widow or fatherless child. So it extends beyond sojourners. And you see these two commonly put together. Sojourners and widows and orphans are kind of all lumped together into one group quite often. Because they are all people who are at a disadvantage. Okay, so these two verses establish what I'm calling the redemptive principle. The principle that pops up throughout the law, and it's mentioned more times even in our discussion here, the principle that you came from Egypt as slaves, and I redeemed you. And this is really all that Exodus says about slavery. So let's jump to Leviticus. Leviticus is everybody's favorite book because they get to learn all about all the festivals and all the sacrifices and exactly how much blood and liver you need for a sacrifice. So the question, at the end, when we finish the Exodus, we're left with the question, okay, so slavery has boundaries, but why was it allowed? You know, why didn't God just say, hey, you came from Egypt as slaves, guess what? No more slavery. You can't. Nobody's slaves anymore because you guys know what it's like. So why was it even allowed? And I think that's one of the tough questions people deal with. Why was slavery even allowed to exist then if it was bad? Let's go to Leviticus 19, verses 33 and 34. When a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall do him no wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as a native among you, and you shall love him as yourself. For you are strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Okay? It doesn't mention slavery, but again, it's a repetition of the redemption principle. He's establishing here in Leviticus as well that you don't do any wrong to the stranger sojourning with you. You treat him as a native. You love him as yourself. Because again, you know what it's like to be a sojourner in a land. And then he ends with, for I am the Lord your God. Okay? That's his, he's saying, listen, I'm the one who redeemed you. You got to listen to me. Right? This is, you know, I am your covenant God. All right, but chapter 25. Again, Leviticus 19, I just wanted to mention that because again, non-Jews were not a slave class, All right? God is not establishing you have the Jewish people, and then you have the people whom you can enslave. That's not at all what he is saying. He's saying the non-Jews are people, you got to love them. You got to treat them as natives to the land. Okay? They are guests in your land, just as you were a stranger, an outcast in Egypt. All right, chapter 25 in Leviticus. There's a lot here to read through, but I think it's important to get the full context to understand this. We're going to read from verses 23 through 55, and that seems like a lot. But again, I think that's important. We'll start with verses 23 through 34 to give some context. Moses writes here, "The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. For you are strangers and sojourners with me, and in all the country you possess, you shall allow redemption of the land." Okay, what is he talking about here? The land. Okay, think back to the book of Joshua, to Moses, forward the book of Joshua. Okay, you have the book of Joshua, and what does Joshua do with all the land in the book of Joshua? He apportions it to all the tribes. He says, tribe of Judah, you have this land. Tribe of Simeon, you have this land, and so on. The only tribe not to receive land were the Levites, because they're serving God. Okay, and so they were given different cities. So what he's saying here is, listen, your family has certain land that it belongs to your family that God has given your family. And if you sell that land, it can't belong to somebody else. It's your land. Okay, it's not like what we our society here, where we buy property and it's our private property, and whoever sold it to us, too bad. You know, it's not yours anymore. Now it's mine. That's not the way it worked here, because the land was not taken. The land was given by God. And so the land of Judah, the tribe of Judah, does not travel. Okay. The tribe of Judah can't say, well, I want to live in the north, not in the south. They can't. Okay, that's not the land God gave them. And so, it begins here with this principle. If you sell your land to somebody from another tribe, they have to eventually give it back. It can't stay theirs. And in all the country you possess, you shall allow redemption of the land. Okay, no matter where you are in the country. If you sell land, you can redeem. So why would you sell land if it's going to come back to you anyway? Why would you sell land? Just because of the fun of redemption? It's because you need money. Okay, you need money. So you're going to sell the land knowing that you can now invest that money, you can use that money, and when it's time to redeem the land, you can buy the land back and you now have money to live on it. Okay, this is the principle here. Okay, verse 25, if your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, then his nearest redeemer shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. And if a man has no one to redeem it, and then himself becomes prosperous and finds sufficient means to redeem it, let him calculate the years since he has sold it and pay back the balance of the man whom he sold it, and then return to his property. But if he does not have sufficient means to recover it, then what he sold shall remain in the hand of the buyer until the year of Jubilee, and the Jubilee shall be released, and he shall return it to his property. If a man sells a dwelling house in a walled city, he may redeem it within a year of its sale. For a full year, he shall have the right of redemption. And, well, all the way through verse 34 is more of the same. It's all property. And again, the basic idea is, if you need money, you can sell part of your land, but then it comes back to you. You can redeem it. If you can't redeem it, then somebody who is part of your tribe can redeem it. Okay, let's go to verse 35 then. And this is following that same principle of the property redemption. Okay, the idea here again is the land is God's, the land is not theirs. So, and then the idea is also the Jews are sojourners in God's land. Okay, the Jews are sojourners in the land. Jump to verse 35 through 38. Following that principle, if your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you, You shall support him as though he were a stranger and a sojourner, and he shall live with you. Take no interest in him or profit, but fear your God, that your brother may live beside you. You shall not lend him your money at interest, nor give him your food for profit. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan, and to be your God. Okay, so your brother becomes poor and incapacitated. He can't work. Take care of him is the basic principle. Okay, here. 39 through 55 then. The question is, what do we do with an able-bodied Jew who can work but is in poverty? What do we do with him? And so 39 through 55, if your brother becomes poor beside you and sells himself to you, you shall not make him serve as a slave. He shall be with you as a hired worker and as a sojourner. He shall serve with you until the year of the Jubilee. Okay, that's, you familiar with Jubilee? It's 49 years. It's seven sabbatical, you know, terms. And so 49 years. After 49 years, he's free to go. But he's not a slave. He's a hired worker. He's working off his debt, basically, is the idea here. So if a fellow Jew is in poverty, hire him until he has worked off his debt. It is basically what this is saying. If after 49 years he has not paid off his debt, let him free anyway. Then he shall go out from you, he and his children with him, and go back to his own clan and return to possession of his fathers. For they are my servants whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as slaves. Okay, you catch this here? He's saying, listen, Jewish people are already slaves. Who are they slaves to? They're slaves to God. He says, listen, nobody will enslave a Jew because a Jew is my slave. I redeemed him from Egypt. He is my people. And so you do not enslave Jews. They are my people. Okay, this is a special covenant relationship with God he's establishing here. You shall not rule over him ruthlessly, but shall fear your God. As for your male and female slaves whom you have. And then here is really the sticky point when it comes to people condemning the scripture for slavery. Because they look at verses 44 and following without the context of all the preceding. So 44, as for your male and female slaves whom you may have, you may buy male and female slaves from among the nations that are around you. You may also buy from among the strangers who sojourn with you and their clans that are with you, who have been born in your land, and they may be your property. You may bequeath them to your sons after you to inherit as a possession forever. You may make slaves of them, but over your brothers, the people of Israel, you shall not rule one over another ruthlessly. So does this passage justify slavery? Does this passage justify enslaving people and keeping them as slaves and passing them on as inheritance to your sons and your daughters? That appears to be what it's saying. And for antebellum plantation owners, this is a favorite proof text to go to justify slavery. When the Bible says that we can do this. As long as they're not Christians, right? A brief side note. Why did people originally begin getting slaves from Africa? Because for a long time, they would get slaves from European countries. And it goes back to the Pope. The Pope decreed, and at this point in time, most of Europe was Catholic, the Pope decreed that you cannot enslave a fellow Catholic. So you can't get your slaves from Europe. So where do you go? Well, if you're Columbus, you go to the Americas and you enslave people in the Caribbean. Or you can get slaves from Africa because they're not Catholic. And as long as you don't become Catholic, they're fair game, right? Whether they're from Africa, whether from the Caribbean, or whether they're from, you know, Australia, or wherever they happen to go, that they are not Catholic, as long as they're not Catholic. And then that principle just kind of disappeared over time and became more ethnic, than it did religious. So, that's a side note. But here, going back to this passage, when we look at the full context, like we just did, this passage is not saying, hey, you are free to go enslave people from other nations. Because we've already seen that's not allowed. You can't do that. We have the redemption principle. Okay, you treat them with respect. You know what it's like to be a sojourner. We see the kidnapping principle. If you enslave somebody, then you die. You can't take somebody's life in enslavement. Okay, nowhere is it allowed to go and enslave. And even here, in this passage, doesn't say enslave. It says slave. It says you may buy from among the strangers who sojourn with you, and so on. And so the principle here is you may buy slaves. Whom do you buy them from? Slave traders? But if you look at the full context of the Jews, who were selling the Jews as slaves? They were selling themselves. Why? Because they were in poverty. Because in an economic system like this, that's how you get out of poverty. You sell yourself into slavery for a time until you have redeemed the price. And so, you look at the context. What this is saying is you are purchasing as slaves these people. And when it says they'll be your property, bequeath them to your sons after you to inherit and so on, it's not saying these people are forever slaves. What principle that applied to the Jews does not apply to non-Jews in terms of redemption from slavery? For the Jews, how long was a Jew supposed to be a slave? 6 years, then he's set free. That principle is set for Jewish slaves. It's not set for non-Jewish slaves. And it doesn't mean that they are now slaves forever and ever. What it means is they are slaves until their debt is paid off. There's no early release from your slavery because of the six-year rule. Because you're not part of the covenant. Okay, that's a Sabbath of years. You're not a part of that covenant. And so you're a slave until your debt is paid off, which may extend to past the master's lifespan into his son's lifespan. And so and again, this is not just from this passage. This is from looking at all of the law statements on slavery and on freedom and on sojourners. Then he continues it with verse 47 and on. If a sojourner, a stranger or a sojourner with you becomes rich, and your brother beside him becomes poor and sells himself to the stranger or sojourner with you or to a member of the stranger's clan, then after he is sold, he may be redeemed. Okay, so, and he goes on to explain it some more. The basic idea here is, listen, if you're a Jew and you are sold into slavery to a non-Jew, that six-year rule still applies. After 6 years, you are set free. And this goes back to God's principle. The Jews are my people. You do not enslave my people. So after 6 years, he is set free. He is redeemed. Okay, and so he goes on and describes that some more. And redemption and all of that. And then jump down to verse 55 at the end of chapter 25 of Leviticus. His final principle here, after all of that discussion on slavery in Leviticus 25, here is the principle that ties everything in this chapter together. For it is to me that the people of Israel are servants. They are my servants, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So Leviticus 25 is setting up, the Jews have a special relationship with God, and because of that, there are restrictions on how their slavery terms go. Non-Jews are not part of that covenant, and so those restrictions are lifted for them, specifically the redemption. after 6 years. And so, the question at the end of Exodus was, well, that I posed, it wasn't your question. Why was slavery even still a thing? Well, we find out why in Leviticus. Because it was an economic system for getting people out of poverty and setting them on their feet again. It was a debt relief program. We have all kinds of programs in America for debt relief. We have all kinds of programs for people in poverty. These did not exist in the ancient world. Their plan was, well, slavery. You sell yourself or you sell a family member to slavery, and then that is how you get out of debt. And it was never intended to be forever and ever enslavement. In the book of Jeremiah, one of God's accusations against the Jews was that as they were taking on Jewish slaves, they were not honoring the six-year redemption period, and they were keeping them on. And so there was that abuse. Of course, if you read the Old Testament, the Jews abused a lot of laws, but even that one was abused. So Deuteronomy, just want to look at three passages a little more quickly, because Leviticus and Exodus have really given the most of the information here. But Deuteronomy chapter 15, verses 7 through 18. Keep in mind that the book of Deuteronomy was written to the Jews who are about to enter the promised land. Exodus and Leviticus were written to the Jews who just exited Egypt. So, logically, if God were setting up a method for enslaving non-Jews, he would spell it out mostly in Deuteronomy, right? Because they're about to enter the promised land, here's what you can do. But he doesn't. What does he give us in Deuteronomy? Well, chapter 15, verses 7 through 18. He writes, "If among you one of your brothers shall become poor, in any of your towns within your land that the Lord your God has given you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother, but you shall open your hand to him and lend him sufficient for his need, whatever it may be. Take care lest there be an unworthy thought in your heart, and you say, 'The seventh year, the year of release, is near,' and your eye look grudgingly on your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cry to the Lord against you, and you be guilty of sin. You shall give to him freely, and your heart shall not be grudging when you give to him, because for this the Lord your God will bless you in your work and in all that you undertake. For there will never cease to be poor in the land. Therefore I command you, you shall open wide your hand to your brother, to the needy and to the poor in your land. If your brother, a Hebrew man or Hebrew woman, is sold to you, he shall serve you 6 years. The seventh year you shall let him go free from you. And when you let him go free from you, you shall not let him go empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally out of your flock, out of your threshing floor, out of your winepress, as the Lord your God has blessed you, you shall give to him. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this today. But if he says to you, 'I will not go out from you,' because he loves you and your household, since he is well off with you, then you shall take an awl and put it through his ear to the door, and he shall be your slave forever. And to your female slave you shall do the same. It shall not seem hard to you when you let him go free from you. For at half the cost of a hired worker, he has served you 6 years. So the Lord your God will bless you in all that you do." In the very first passage in Exodus 21, we saw that a slave can say, "I want to stay with my master forever." We ask the question, why? Why possibly would a slave want to stay with his master forever? Well, Deuteronomy gives the answer. Because he's well off. He is economically better well off serving his master than he would be on his own. And so he offers, and so then why the awl? Well, okay, so then he offers for, he can't after 15 years say, "Okay, I'm done. I'm done now." It's he is now making a contract. Fortunately, we're no longer we no longer sign our contracts with awls and doorposts. But so entering the promised land here, same principles. Okay, there's nothing new in the principles, but what Moses addresses here is the attitude. When you let your slave go up to 6 years, don't do it grudgingly. Don't say, man, the guy still owes so much debt. You know, he can't survive on his own, I don't think. You know, you can't judge him like that. You can't say, well, you know, now I have to go hire somebody to take his place. He says, no, let him go freely. Give him gifts. Be generous. Send him with joy. And it goes back to the redemption principle, right? The same redemption principle. Because I redeemed you out of Egypt. Right, in verse 15, you should, you know, remember you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this today. Again, it's Deuteronomy. These people were not slaves in Egypt. Their parents were. And so God is reminding them, this principle still exists. Even if you don't remember servitude, your people were enslaved, and I did redeem your people. So that same principle, the poor are not going away. You're not going to end poverty with this. But respond to their need with joy and with generosity and with enthusiasm. Okay, help out those in need. This idea of slavery here that God is allowing with Moses is not for the master's sake. This is not something selfish where the master can say, aha, I can now have free labor. This is for the worker's sake. And so, Deuteronomy 23, 15 and 16. And by the way, if I haven't made clear already, this is not referring to antebellum slavery. Okay, I'm not in any way defending American slavery, because that was not what this is. It's completely different. It's very abusive. Deuteronomy 23, 15 and 16, really quickly here. You shall not give up to a master his slave who has escaped from his master to you. He shall dwell with you in your midst in the place that he shall choose within one of your towns where it suits you. Him, you shall not wrong him. That's interesting, isn't it? A slave escapes his master and comes to you. What do? You don't give him back. You give him a place to live. You set him up in a town. You provide protection and goods. He doesn't explain why and why not. But this is not talking about Hebrew slaves. This is talking about slaves from outside, from non-Jews. What do? Well, you leave them free. Deuteronomy 24, 17 through 22. Back with the fugitive slave laws before the Civil War, I can guarantee you the plantation owners were not quoting that verse when their slaves escaped to the North. But Deuteronomy 24, 17 through 22, this is our last verse in the law, but again it goes back to the redemption principle. You should not pervert the justice due to the sojourner, and so on. And it talks about the reaping and so on. And verse 22, finally here, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this. Okay? The gleaning principle. Remember the book of Ruth, where she could go and glean from the fields? Okay, this she was a sojourner. She was not Jewish. And so, that's what the law says about slavery. And at the core of it all is the redemption principle. And so, this is a series on Ephesians. And my actual text was Ephesians chapter 6, 5 through 9. But I really thought it would be important to give this context before jumping into this, because this passage is not saying if you are, you know, a slave, then, you know, you're always a slave. That's your class. It's I just want to throw a couple of principles out. I'm not because of time, but he tells bond servants is a term here. Greek and Roman slavery is similar to the ancient. It's very common for someone to sell himself into slavery to learn a trade. Yeah, think of internships today. It's not slavery, but to learn a trade or sell himself into slavery to pay off debt. And it's usually upward mobility. It's very common for a slave then to become somebody who runs a successful business. And so it was not forever slavery. But bond servants, you know, obey your earthly masters, okay? Set a basic principle here. God is your real master. With fear and trembling, sincere heart, as you would Christ. So again, the same idea that your work is a significant responsibility. And you work with purity of motivation, as you would to Christ. And this goes back to the redemption principle. I need to bring this up again. You know, in the Old Testament, the redemption principle was God redeemed you from Egypt. Well, the redemption principle extends to the New Testament, except it's no longer Egypt. Christ redeemed you from sin, from death. And so now we are, as Romans states, we are now slaves to God, just as the Jews were slaves to God. That same redemption principle exists here for us. And he goes on, it's not by way of eye service and basic principles of working well. You work to honor God, not to reap rewards and so on. With goodwill. But verse 8, the basic principle here, knowing that whatever good anyone does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether he's a bond servant or is free. And Paul is establishing here that social status is insignificant. Whether you are a master or a slave, you're going to answer to God. And God does not discern differently between the two. So don't cater to what's your master, to your master's whims necessarily. You want to work well, but you're working to honor God. And then verse 9, masters to principals. Masters to slaves, you know, do the same to you, which I find interesting, okay? Because what he's doing here is he's establishing the slaves as more kind of the more important role. And masters, you do that also. The same thing I commanded them, you do that also. It's and then it ends here with there is no partiality with God, okay? No partiality with him. And Paul here may not have said, free your slaves. He did not end slavery. Again, in his time, it was an economic system of getting people out of debt. But what he did do was set the principle for emancipation. He set the principle that slaves and masters, there's no partiality before God. There is equality within the church. There is equality before God. And he what he gave was a theological basis for ending slavery in this passage, as well as in other places in his epistles, retaining the idea of economic responsibility, caring for those in your church. You don't end that, but time has gotten away, and I didn't spend as much time in Ephesians as I wanted to, but I hope that, I just want to say one more thing, though. The idea of slaves and masters is a household term here. Paul's talking about household terms. It's no longer a household term for us. So does it apply to work? And I would say yes, this does apply to your boss and employee relationship. Because in this point in time, industries were cottage industries. That means if you ran a business, you ran it in your home. Your slaves were your employees. And so taking that same principle and extending it, therefore, your master, okay, the one for whom you are an employee is your boss. And so I would say that the principles you see in these verses apply to that workplace scenario. And if you're self-employed, then you've got to work out who's the boss and who's not. All right, well, let's go ahead and pray, and then I'll pastor in the service. Father, we're grateful for your word. We're grateful for the knowledge that we have of the cultures as well as of the scriptures. And especially, Lord, we are very grateful for what I'm calling here the redemption principle, that you did redeem Egypt or Israel out of Egypt, and you did redeem us out of sin. And I pray that redemption is will be at the forefront of how we respond to people in our lives. I pray in Christ's name, amen.